It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at some of the challenges of teaching about racism and the civil rights movement in schools and colleges. First, when you're behind the wheel, would you admit to speeding? Sometimes in some places? If so, you're not alone. According to the auto insurance comparison site, The Zebra, 9 in 10 drivers say they exceed the speed limit, even though 8 in 10 say it's dangerous, and about a third say it's always unacceptable. A 2016 AAA report showed that half of all drivers went 15 over the speed limit on the highway in the previous month. 45% said they went 10 over in residential areas. Officials say speeding is dangerous to everyone on the road. In fact, the National Highway Traffic Safety Association says in 2019, speeding killed more than 9,400 people in the U.S. That's about a quarter of all traffic deaths. Our next guest looked into Americans' addiction to speeding, including why we do it and efforts to slow us down, why he says the nation's most disobeyed law is, quote, dysfunctional from top to bottom. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you drive over the speed limit? If so, how fast do you go? Do you have a rule? 5 over or 10 over on the highway, say? Have you been pulled over and ticketed? Do you see a lot of unsafe, fast driving when you're out and driving? If you're a police officer, what do you see out on the roads? And are there changes you'd like to see to get us to slow down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate who focuses on cities, transportation, housing, and the environment. He's currently working on a book about parking. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
You describe speeding as a national health problem. Can you talk about why a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, I think you said so yourself in your introduction. Nearly 10,000 people die each year in collisions that involve speeding. There are thousands and thousands of more injuries that involve speeding. What's particularly perplexing about this is that even though cars are getting safer and safer for the people inside them, those numbers appear to be going up. In the first 6 months of 2021, traffic fatalities in the U.S. rose by about 18%, which is the largest increase since the U.S. DOT started counting. And that's double the rate of the previous year's surge, which happened in spite of the fact that everybody was staying home for 2 months of the year. So it's a deadly problem, and it's getting worse.
And people are paying a lot of attention to this. As you mentioned, with the pandemic, roads might have been emptier, but we were driving faster. I assume some data is still coming in, but what do we know about how the pandemic changed our driving speeds?
Yeah, so the pandemic shutdown lowered the total number of miles traveled in this country by 13%, which is not surprising when you think about the fact that many of us may not have gone to work or, you know, didn't go to social events. I mean, we're talking about March, April, May 2020. So the sort of when this was just a real public health emergency that was just beginning almost 2 years ago now. But in spite of vehicle miles traveled falling by 13%, the per mile death rate rose by 24%. That's the greatest increase in a century. And that's because everybody was going so fast on all these empty roads. But what's weird is that that didn't then revert back to the norm in 2021. On the contrary, as I just mentioned, in 2021, it looks like traffic fatalities rose again by 20%.
I want to split this up because highways and residential roads are kind of different stories in some ways. You mentioned how cars are safer for the people in them now. Let's get on those residential roads. Talk about the impact of speed on the people who aren't in the cars, the pedestrians, bicyclists.
Yeah, so that's huge. I mean, I think part of my thesis here is that, you know, we're making a mistake by treating speeding as one issue. Part of that is that there's a big difference between the risks that you create for the people around you when you go 5 miles over the speed limit on the interstate versus when you go 15 miles over the speed limit on a residential street. For pedestrians, whose death counts are also rising as part of that 10,000 deaths a year number, pedestrians' odds of being killed in a collision are about 10% when the driver is going 23 miles an hour, and they rise to 75% when the driver is going 50 miles an hour. So there's a really important zone there where we have cars and people existing in the same spaces where it's super important to get people to drive a little bit slower. And most people do, I think, drive at a safe speed through residential neighborhoods. But there are a few who don't, and they pose an outsized risk to those around them, not just people, but if you've ever seen an out-of-control car careen down a residential street, to structures as well.
Talking to Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate. He wrote a recent piece on Americans' love of speeding while driving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How big a problem do you think this is? What do you see from other people on the road? Do you drive over the speed limit often yourself? Do you want to see changes in enforcement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Henry, you point out there's a pretty common perception that when I drive fast, I'm doing it safely because I know what I'm doing. But those other idiots are driving fast. They're putting us all at risk. We kind of, I don't know, what are we doing there?
Yeah, that's actually what drew me to this topic in the first place. I think there's lots of aspects of society where something is dangerous, but it's also fun and we like it, and so we permit it because that's, you know, society is a balancing act, right? Like, you know, fireworks or alcohol or something like that. Like, these things obviously are not great for our health, but they're fun, and so we've decided they're going to be allowed. And what gets me about speeding is that simultaneously, everybody agrees that it's bad on a societal level and that other people shouldn't do it, but that when I do it, it's fine. And to me, it recalls a famous line of George Carlin's, who said, everyone going faster than you is a maniac and everyone going slower than you is an idiot. And that seems to be the societal position on speeding.
Let's look at some solutions now. First of all, the drivers. Are there things we can do to educate ourselves on how to drive a safe? I guess we know driving slower is safer. How can we live that?
Yeah, there's a few things that I think we could do. I mean, a lot of the focus is on enforcement, right? Mm-hmm. It's like hire more state troopers, radar guns, speed cameras, all this stuff. And we can talk about that in a moment. But I think right off the bat, there's some fundamental changes we could make. I mean, the easiest one is to design roads to correspond to the speed that we want people to drive on them. I think often people feel that the road is telling them, suggesting a certain speed. And that's true. Engineers know when they design a road that there's a design speed at which it will feel safe. And if we want those roads, if we want people to drive slower on those roads, the best way to do it is to redesign them. And that's particularly true in the places where you have people turning in and out of driveways, you have kids crossing the street. Those are places where engineers really need to start redesigning roads with safety in mind, rather than just trying to get everyone, and when I say everyone, I mean drivers here, from point A to point B as fast as possible.
In my town and others around the state, I think sometimes there is that kind of redesign on the kind of streets you're talking about, but the only change is the number on the speed limit sign, 30 down to 25, 35 down to 30. I was on one such road today, and, you know, maybe more enforcement, but no other physical changes to the road. Is that doomed to failure?
I think it is, yes. I think that doesn't really work. We're all accustomed to not paying attention to the number posted on the speed limit sign, and for good reason. Nobody around us does. We know that the police don't really take this law at face value, which is to say they don't necessarily ticket you for going 1 or 2 miles an hour over. But yeah, I would argue that if we actually want people to slow down, and we could redesign the streets, we can have a more rigorous program of driver education. I think it's kind of unusual that you learn to drive, you take an exam when you're 15 or 16 years old, and you're never tested again. It's a little surprising. And then the third thing, obviously, is we could put some sort of governor in the vehicles. And that could be for people who have a proven record of dangerous driving. Or the other thing, obviously, is that we're starting to see autonomous cars. And with those, it's not even a question of your personal liberty. It's do we want to have computer programs on the road that are going 20 miles over the speed limit? And that's a question I think we should probably address as a society before all those cars get put out there and you have computer programs that are directing them to go so far over the speed limit.
We're talking about Americans' apparent need for speed on the roads with Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate, who focuses on transportation and other issues. And you could join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you often see people driving too fast when you're driving on the highway, in your neighborhood maybe, or on downtown streets? What do you think we should do about it, if anything, if you are in law enforcement and have to pull people over? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, the idea of speed traffic cameras that will send you a ticket. 800-642-1234. What do you think of that? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about speeding on American roadways. Our guest wrote a piece about our apparent addiction to speeding on highways and residential roads. He notes that one in four deadly crashes in the U.S. involves at least one speeding driver. Henry Grabar is with us from Slate. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see too much speeding on the road? What would you do to fix it, to prevent it? What questions do you have about how we design our roads, how we enforce or sometimes don't enforce our laws? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Henry, before we go to our callers, I wanted to get into this automatic speeding camera ticket idea. Big in Europe, not so hot yet in the United States.
No, people hate them. And this is a point on which I think that having written this big article about speeding, I think my take has diverged from that of most people. I think the greater infringement on our liberties is probably having an armed police officer pull you over at 90 miles an hour and search your vehicle, as opposed to a camera sending you a ticket in the mail. I appear to be in the minority in holding that view, but the argument in favor of it is that if we're trying to actually clamp, like if we're trying to crack down on dangerous speeding, which I think we can all agree is a minority of drivers on the road, you know them when you see them, they're weaving in and out of lanes, going 25 over the limit. Our current system of, you know, having a policeman here and there with a radar gun is just not that good for catching those people. And the argument for cameras is that if you install them in places where you have, say, pedestrians, cyclists, parents with strollers, you know, vulnerable people, you create a much more effective system of enforcement. And once the system of enforcement is more effective, you can say lower the fines, right? Because you're catching more people. You can adjust the way the cameras work so you don't, you know, get everybody going over the speed limit, but maybe only get people going 15 or 20 above. And then finally, you get a pretty good data set of who the dangerous drivers are, which we definitely do not get when we rely on speeding tickets, because, as you know, you can speed for years and years without getting a speeding ticket. It's not a particularly, it's not a data set that tells us a lot about who the dangerous drivers are.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Evan is with us in Ashland. Evan, hi.
Hey, I think, at least in where I live, part of the issue with speeding is just, it's kind of an issue with road design. There's a, I want to say Highway 2 runs into town. It's a two lanes each way, four lane highway. And going in through Ashland, it's still four lanes, two lanes each way. But the speed limit it gets cut from 55.
We lost Evan there, but 55, I'm guessing down to something like 25 going through downtown Ashland. How big a problem is this, Henry, that kind of design? We have this is common in Wisconsin. You are 55 until the road takes you through town.
Yeah, I think that is not an effective method of getting people to slow down. I myself have gotten a ticket in one such situation in upstate New York. And the truth is, as a driver, you just, at a certain point, you just don't read those signs. The real thing that you're taking your cues from is the way the road is designed. And there's lots of really easy things we can do to signal to drivers that they are entering a densely populated area where they need to slow down. And the fact that we just rely on a sign on the side of the road, I think, is a sign maybe of a sort of lazy approach to design, but also potentially reminds us that the way speeding works is it's a system for raising revenue in a lot of places. And so, you know, in some places you do wonder, do authority figures actually want people to slow down, or do they want to issue speeding tickets?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Bill now in the Northwoods. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. I wanted to wish everybody a happy COVID-free New Year. And I really enjoy your topic. And one thing I've been kind of scrolling through the internet, thank God for that, that a lot of these police officers, and they're finding out with traffic stops and expired plates and speeding, that they're better off to just photograph them and send pictures or the tickets in the mail, because traffic stops can escalate to, you know, a dangerous situation for the officer.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Henry, you were starting to touch on that, and that's something you do focus on in your piece. Fewer interactions between a traffic enforcement officer and drivers might make people safer in other ways.
Yeah, I that is such an important part of this, Bill. Thank you for bringing it up. I mean, where to begin? We know, I think fewer interactions with police would be a good thing from a civil liberties perspective. It would be good for police because it would free up their time to do more important work, solving crimes and stopping crimes. The other thing is, Bill hinted at this, but there are statistics. Getting pulled over on the highway is the number one way that Americans interact with police. It serves as the start of one in three police shootings. So this is not like a niche little thing, right? This is basically the foundation of Americans' experience with the police. And speed cameras, whatever your problems may be with them, offer great promise in sort of getting rid of the traffic stop as a concept.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Henry Grabar from Slate, looking at speeding in America, its risks, how to deal with it. Back to your calls now. Kristen is with us in Eau Claire. Kristen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I thought that the cameras would be a more equitable solution because in general, there's a perception that maybe racial and gender bias causes more men and people of color to be pulled over than Caucasian people, and that the use of cameras would eliminate that bias.
Kristen, thanks for the call. Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, there's more than a suggestion. Black drivers are 20% more likely to be stopped, according to a study from last year, or rather that would be 2020. And this is because part of the dysfunctional nature of the speed limit is that it makes criminals of us all, because it is a law that we all disobey, that we know is sort of meant to be disobeyed, that engineers know we're going to disobey, police know we're going to disobey. And yes, it gives the police the right to ostensibly pull anyone over at all. And so I don't think that the system we have is good at all. And I agree, cameras can be, theoretically at least, a race-neutral method of enforcing the law, in addition to avoiding the sometimes tragic consequences of highway stops. Of course, the program to install the cameras has to be well designed, and not designed with the aim of raising revenue, but rather with the aim of ensuring public safety on the road. I think that's important.
Kristen, thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Cyril in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to mention that speed not only is an unsafe habit for drivers, but just generally bad driving habits in particular, such as coming to an intersection and you're going to make a turn and you decide to cut the corner so that you don't have to turn the steering wheel as far, and having a vehicle coming on the opposite lane coming towards you as you're cutting the corner. I live within distance of a major intersection where it's only a two-way stop, and every year since we've moved here, and I've lived here 30 years, there's been at least one or two crash and boom wow. accidents.
Well, Cyril, stay safe there. Henry, I wonder how much of a problem like that and like speeding is we need to be better drivers versus we need to design our roads better.
I think the two go together. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, Cyril, but like when it snows and the snow has first fallen and there's this thick layer of snow on the road, if you look at the road from above, you start to see the paths that drivers take and you start to realize how much of the space of the road is actually not being used by drivers. And I love to look at that in, say, a little, you know, downtown of a small town. And if you look at that from above, you get a sense of, does all this space really need to be roadway space? And I think that drivers respond to all that space being asphalt by doing things like cutting corners. But when it snows, you sort of get a sense of really, we could begin to build out, say, a sidewalk here, build out a planter full of trees there, and reduce the amount of space that drivers have. And that's one way that design cues get people to slow down and drive more safely, irrespective of even if we're making them, you know, take a class or something like that.
Cyril, thanks for that call. In just our last half a minute, Henry, do you see at the federal, state, or local levels people saying, hey, yeah, the speeding's a problem, we got to try something different?
You know who did say something about this was the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, who was talking about the rise in fatalities since the pandemic started. And he said, we cannot and should not accept these fatalities. Unfortunately, when it comes to redesigning the roads, we have not seen, I would say, a ton of movement. And the other thing is that speed cameras remain incredibly unpopular, notwithstanding the opinions of WPR callers.
Henry, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate who focuses on cities and transportation. We talked to him about what he calls our addiction to speeding. Coming up after the news, a historian and teaching educator joins us to look at bills in the Wisconsin legislature that would limit or prohibit teaching about systemic racism in the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at Wisconsin Biographies, a PBS Wisconsin tool that helps kids learn about Wisconsinites who made history. Now, as the nation marks Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, there are lots of questions and debates in the political world about the best ways to teach the history of race, racism, and the civil rights movement in American schools. In the last couple years, a wave of anti-racism protests and efforts like the 1619 Project called for more attention to that history and to the long-term impacts of racism. That was met by a backlash centering around a concept called critical race theory. And Republicans in state legislatures in Wisconsin and around the country worked on laws to change the school curriculum and define what teachers could and couldn't say about race and history. A Wisconsin historian joins us now for a look at the question, how should we teach kids about race and American history? You can join in at 800-642-1234. With your answer to that question. If you're a parent of kids, what kind of things do you want to see them learning at school? If you're a current or former educator, what did you find difficult or maybe fulfilling about teaching students about the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr.? What kind of responses do you get from students, their parents, from your community? What thoughts do you have about bills which don't mention critical race theory by name, but say they target it? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Robert S. Smith is the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching, and Outreach at Marquette University. He's the author of the book Black Liberation from Reconstruction to Black Lives Matter, which came out last summer. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here this afternoon, especially today. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's not always easy to talk about race and racism, even among adults. When it comes to schools, what are some of your baselines for the way we should think about how to teach kids about race, racism, and American history?
Well, you know, it's probably the hardest topic to discuss in a number of ways. I think the first thing we have to do, as always, and I'm going to borrow from Marquette University's mission, we have to be in search of truth. That's what has to guide all of what we do with any educational approach, but particularly with history. And in that process, there are certainly debates that can help inform and help us approach truth. And so you get multiple perspectives, you get various approaches, and then there is indeed this important process of rigor that it gets us to some understanding of historical truth, and that can still be debated in all kinds of ways. And so it's the discourse that we have to be committed to first and foremost. But I do think when we talk K-12, we have to think about the age of young people. We have to think about what we should teach young people so that they can best absorb some of the complicated and difficult topics. We have to be committed to it over years and build upon ideas and topics in our school curricula. And in that process, then for the more challenging and difficult and indeed violent portions of our history, we have to make sure that we have a full contextualization of the individuals involved so that we humanize everybody who's involved in those historical dramas, and then also continually make sure we're paying attention to policy and law and all those other components to help us understand that. I know I just dropped a lot in that, which probably made folks go to sleep, but you asked a history professor a question like that.
And I asked you a big, broad question, too. Now, where things seem to get a political response these days is when we say we're looking at this part of our history and connecting the dots today and saying we're still feeling the impacts of slavery through segregation, through voting rights, property rights, that sort of thing in 2022. What do you think about teaching that connects the dots between our history when it comes to race and racism and our current state of racial relations?
Well, in some cases you can connect particular dots. And, you know, for example, housing and home ownership is one of those histories that the dots get connected very easily in a lot of respects. In other capacities, in other arenas, you might see a history echo more than have a direct connection. You know, voting rights has some very connect ties to it. We've worked much harder as a nation to deny large numbers of people the right to vote than we have worked to include more people in that process. And yet there are also these ways, and so those are some direct examples. But in terms of the echoing, you see the ways that disparities in any number of arenas continue. We see moments of progress in some ways during key reform eras. And as you mentioned, we then see backlashes and retrenchment. And so that's where the echoing becomes a useful way to think about it, because you don't necessarily have to have these direct connections all the time, but you do need to have a sense of where you've been in the past, what looks familiar from some of those previous developments, because that then gives us a sense of how we get out of these situations, and that indeed we can get out of them in some way if we're creative about the ways that we engage people and voice and policy.
Talking to Robert S. Smith, historian at Marquette University, looking at how we teach about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in U.S. schools. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. You pointed us toward a speech, the Drum Major Instinct speech from February of 1968. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. here, talking about conversations he had with the white wardens of the jail where he was held in Birmingham.
And I said, you are put in the position of supporting your oppressor, because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you're white. And you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us every time we have a march.
There's a lot of Dr. Martin Luther King's speaking to talk about. Why did you point this one out to us in particular?
Well, you know, there are a couple of, I think, important components about this. This is just a couple of months before we lose Dr. King. And it provides this window into, you know, toward the end of this speech. And I encourage everybody listening to go revisit the Drum Major Instinct today. It's a brilliant, brilliant conversation that Dr. King is having from his position as a leader of a movement, the face and voice of a movement, but then also his role as clergy, but then that very serious and very real journey we all go through, and that's you know, determining what our life legacy will look like. What is it that we leave when we are no longer here? And he's grappling with those very serious questions. And at the same time, it highlights and emphasizes again how brilliant of an intellectual Dr. King was, because using that drum major instinct idea, he then critiques not only the individual self, but he looks at race prejudice, as we heard in that particular clip. He looks at U.S. global politics in this same lecture. And then, you know, it's a rich engagement with him as a person, a human being, a leader of this important reform era in U.S. history, and then also this astute intellectual as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. Well, I've done this with so many classes, but the one that I guess I'll talk about is second grade, a dual language class, and we would have like a week-long unit on civil rights. And of course, we had to simplify it a lot, so it was mostly Rosa Parks and segregation. And then we would talk about Martin Luther King and the Voting Rights Act, like very, very simplified, but that how he was able to get that passed. And my kids just love it. They always love it. And they're so shocked to find out that segregation exists and that there were all these obstacles to voting. And then when we talk about these people standing up and being courageous and working to change it, they clap. I mean, these kids get really excited about it. And I had one girl who was just, she just started jumping up and down and cheering and like clapping. She was just so happy.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sounds like Sarah must be a good enthusiastic teacher there for one thing. Rob, what do you think of her shocked and inspired her students are?
Well, you know, thanks Sarah, because you know, the work that our teachers are doing, and have always done, but particularly in this moment, we need to all take a moment and thank them seriously over and over and over. You know, so much of the experience with young people, educators witness that moment that a young person's face sort of changes when you know that they've engaged in a topic that's impacting them. It's one of the beautiful moments of being an educator. And that's sort of the gold nuggets of it all. But these are brilliant stories. You know, these are heroes. These are mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and uncles and aunts. They're folks who we walk past every day who've done some remarkable things. The average person has been more central to social change than the leaders themselves. You know, the leaders are important for carrying messages, but it's the day-to-day stories of folks overcoming and doing heroic and remarkable stuff that is so inspiring. And it's important for our young people to hear that so that they know that indeed they are the agents of the future. You know, it's their future that we are in some ways helping to mold, but they are really responsible for that. And it's important, as Dr. King said in the speech, that we all be drum majors for justice, you know, and what better way to do and highlight those important stories, to tell those stories and to encourage young people to be drum majors for justice, but from Dr. Rosa Parks and these other legends.
Thanks for that call, Sarah. We're talking to Robert S. Smith, professor of history and director of the Center for Urban Research, teaching and outreach at Marquette University, looking at how we teach and talk about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in U.S. schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, have you talked with your kid or kids about what they learn in school about the civil rights movement? What do you think about what your school teaches, how they teach it? If you are a teacher, love to hear your experience as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Marquette history professor Robert S. Smith, looking at the ways we teach about race and racism in American schools. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Thank you for the show. And I wanted to ask your guest about other voices, men and women from that period, who he would identify as contemporaries of Dr. King. For example, I had the privilege of a group of us had a conversation and coffee with Andrew Young during, I think it was 1969. So just a quick question about other voices, men and women who were also pivotal during that period. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for the call, Rob. I've heard concerns sometimes that we might get this picture that it was just Dr. King and the civil rights movement. And clearly, as Will was pointing out, it wasn't just him.
Yeah, thanks, Will. That's a great question. And I want to one more time just reemphasize that it's all those faces in those marches whose names we don't know or whose names we may not know in that particular image or something. That those are the folks whose stories are so brilliant as well. And let's always remember those, what we might refer to as grassroots activists who carried those local movements. There are two names that really come to mind that I think are important in this particular moment. And then also folks whose lives and whose ideas have been critical. And that's Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker. And so to my fellow educators out there, these are two folks who are so critical to longstanding movements for racial equality, but then also have inroads and ties and are involved in other struggles, whether it's broadly class-based labor movements, then also movements for gender equality. And so I'd encourage Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker as two key voices that deserve a bit more attention in the classroom. And they are also very complex figures as individuals. And so they provide some room for some other important discussions that are not directly movement related, but certainly play a role in some important topics of the era.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob, I wanted to look at laws being advanced or passed in states around the country, including one effort to pass one in Wisconsin that specify the curriculum and what is okay and not okay. The author of one here in Wisconsin wrote in a memo that the bill doesn't restrict teaching an inquiry about the history of racism, but, quoting, it restricts indoctrination, abusive pedagogies, and state-sanctioned racism, end quote. And then a supporting memo says red flag phrases include things like racial prejudice. What do you think as you look at bills from state lawmakers trying to, I guess, change the way we teach about race and racism?
Yeah, it's disturbing that questions around education and curriculum related matters isn't engaged. This legislative movement, this backlash, if you will, this counter movement, that we don't have the voices of teachers and principals and curricular experts leading the way to move us forward in the classroom. The fact that this is being legislated is the exact reason why we have to explore these topics on and on and on, because these policies feel more like an effort to dismiss the past than to use the past, engage with the past, and become better informed about the past so that our learning today moves forward in effective and progressive ways. And so they're very disturbing. It's also disturbing that in our case in particular, here in Wisconsin, that the legislation encourages lawsuits to be directed at educators and school boards, that, you know, because that just creates more social division. It creates what's already a heavily and hotly, viciously politicized world. It just creates more and more division in our country and at our local levels. These are very problematic and very concerning, because you have experts in the classroom who can give us all the direction we need to make sure that we're teaching our young people appropriately. And to use these kinds of dog whistles, really, it's another echoing of a similar kind of playbook when intellectual thought, when creative thought, when critical thought is under attack.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joe is with us in Jefferson. Joe, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad you're talking about this today. I've found for years speaking with people, mostly white people in suburban areas and whatnot, that they tend to feel like racism is not a problem anymore, and that actually black people use it as an excuse. And this is such a prevalent thing, I think we don't ever talk about it, unfortunately, because it's such a sensitive topic. But when you're calling out basically, like I am now, how much racism is around, you know, white people in general, that's a hot, how do you discuss this issue? And that's why with children, what I was saying to the screener is with education, you can get to the children, but I'm mostly talking about people that are older, obviously. And it's sad that, you know, I don't know how we're going to get to those people that are older. They're in denial and they rewrite history. And this is such a political, I think it's underneath the politics a lot more than people realize. And
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, I know we're focusing on schools here, but do you have thoughts on about having productive conversations among grownups that don't just end in yelling and tears?
Yeah, you know, part of the speech there that Dr. King offered in that clip in particular, just before it, you know, he says that when he was, you know, in jail, he had very calm conversations with the correction officers there about issues associated with race. And that's in 1968. We've obviously devolved significantly because we are in a place where it's very difficult to have any meaningful civil exchange these days. And yet it's great to hear somebody who sounds still willing to have those conversations. So all is not lost. I do want to add that, you know, our education institutions, the educational system more broadly, is the key place where we do have these conversations. And so it's important for us to preserve the richness that we can experience in our education system as a result of an exchange of ideas. And so let's make sure we remember how important our schools and our universities and our colleges are to that project. But I will say that living here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and working with a whole range of community-based organizations and community experts, they are always having conversations that help to raise our collective social IQ on a number of topics. And so I want to make sure to give those hardworking folks a shout out, because they are indeed a part of an important process of public education that's not in our schools, that's outside in our community spaces, in our libraries, in our museums, and all these wonderful institutions that continue to push forward the importance of learning, public learning in those spaces as well.
In our last minute and a half or so, I know there are concerns on every Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day that people worry that we're getting a sanitized version of him. The I Have a Dream speech, the more unifying messages. What do you recommend to get a fuller, rounder understanding of his message?
You know, in some ways, I think that's the case. And I want to say something that could obviously be challenged. It's okay to go back over some of those wonderful stories, even if those are stories that we've heard over and over. There is an importance that goes into making sure that we know some of these key elements. At the very same time, we live in this digitally sophisticated world, and as you all know, in preparation for our conversation, we could share all kinds of information with one another, whether it's actual audio clips of Dr. King, the actual transcripts from his speeches, and you can find these at any number of institutions, particularly work that's been recognized by the family and archives recognized by the King family. So there's a wide array of ways to get to some of the other components to Dr. King that help to tell a fuller story about him as a person, him as a leader, him as a leader in the religious community as well.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Robert S. Smith, the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching, and Outreach at Marquette University. We talked to him this afternoon about some of the challenges educators face when they're teaching about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in American history, and how that work could be limited by bills in the state legislature in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it is this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. on the table this week. Plumbing and electrical problems on the agenda. Don't work on them both at the same time, though. Call in with your questions and solutions related to your wiring and your plumbing. Maybe you have an idea, a solution you figured out yourself. Find out more, get your questions answered. Ask a contractor tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I've heard on the show from a bunch of experts the last couple months that we should up our mask game. If we're wearing masks, we need to go with things like the KN94 or N95 or whatnot. I even talked to a guy called the Mask Nerd. So I decided, okay, I'm in. I got some new masks. It's mostly going well, but I've learned two lessons. One, I have a large face. I mean, I kind of knew that already, but the whole trying out mask project really hammers that home. Two, the cheaper, flimsier kind of masks could go in the back pocket of my jeans, and they'd stay there. These new guys, not so much. I'm already down two masks to mysterious leaps out of my pocket, plus some more near misses. If you want some mask advice, search WPR Mask Nerd on a browser near you, and maybe don't keep them in your back pocket. Mask news you can use. This is Central Time.